The new book, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, gives readers a rare opportunity to engage with the Congresswoman's powerful ideas in her own voice. Many Americans are familiar with Chisholm's importance as the first Black woman in Congress and the first woman and African American to run for president with either major party. This collection of her work establishes Chisholm as an unparalleled public intellectual and Black feminist both in her time and now. Learn more about Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, at ucpress.edu.
Welcome to See How They Run, horse race coverage from the left, brought to you by The Nation. I'm Dee Dee Guttenplan, editor of The Nation. Few questions have bedeviled Democrats as much as the question of how, or even whether, to reverse their decline in rural and blue-collar America. Long gone are the days when the party was seen as the natural home of the working class. Now, the dominant narrative goes, Democrats are a haven for urban, highly educated elites, while the Trump-led GOP makes inroads among working-class voters of all races, thus imperiling the coalition that has sustained Democrats for decades. With states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan on a knife edge this November, the Democrats need every vote they can get. So on today's episode, we're going to kick the tires on the party's relationship to rural voters. We have two guests who live and breathe rural America and who are adamant that, far from being a lost cause for Democrats, many rural and working class voters could be up for grabs if the party made a serious effort to win them over. Jane Klebb is the chair of the Nebraska Democratic Party and the author of Harvest the Vote, How Democrats Can Win Again in Rural America. And Anthony Flacavento is an organic farmer, co-chair of the Rural Urban Bridge Initiative, and co-author of the nation's Rethinking Rural column. Welcome, both of you, to See How They Run. So the most intriguing and, to me, somewhat surprising piece of campaign news in the last week that I saw was an ABC poll that put Harris and Waltz within 4 points of Trump and Vance in Iowa. And so I guess my question to you two mavens of rural America and the rural vote is this for real?
You know, I definitely think what you're seeing is the vibes that we felt and saw on the ground in 2008, where Obama and Biden really did reach rural folks. They brought this sense of hope and optimism, which rural people, despite, you know, having food deserts and hospital deserts and lots of other things going against us in our rural communities, they are always still filled with hope and optimism. So I think you're seeing some of that, no question. I also, you know, deeply believe Walz has really helped the Harris ticket in letting rural people know that they are being seen and heard because he's from rural communities and speaks our language. So I think a combination of those things are happening for sure. And so I definitely think it's real. You see it on the ground, you feel it on the ground.
Yeah, I'll echo that. And I think Waltz is really the key to it, not to take anything away from Vice President Harris, but I think the appointment of Waltz, when a lot of people were saying the safer pick was Shapiro, or they're talking a lot of different things, to put both a real true rural guy and also a guy who spent his congressional career on the Ag Committee, both of those things are a pretty big deal. I don't know if they're first ever, but they're first in a long damn time. And so I think while he still has some deficits, I mean, you know, more rural people give J.D. Vance a favorable rating right now than they do Tim Walz. But that's kind of part of the larger trouble that Dems have with their brand. I think Walz has a chance, especially if he's given the sort of rural portfolio to run with before and after the election. I think it could be enormous.
So how does it look on the ground in Virginia?
Well, on the ground in Virginia, it's looking pretty solid now for Harris and Walz. I think the most of the polls are looking at 3 to 5 point advantage. And I don't know how much of that is Trump's debate performance, versus Harris, and how much is the addition of Walz to the ticket. But I think it's going to be not as much of a big win as people might have hoped. But I think Virginia is out of the danger column now, it looks like to me. In rural Virginia, I don't know if there's any polling data, but I will say that the prevalence of Trump signs, while still strong, are not nearly so overwhelming as 4 years ago, for what that's worth. And the cropping up of people who have Harris Walz as well as Democratic congressional candidate signs out is behind the Republican signs, but surprisingly robust. So yeah, I think things are looking good.
You know, Jane, you talked about vibes, and for some of us, the campaign has been running on vibes since the switch at the top of the ticket. But, you know, what about policy? What have you seen that makes a difference in Nebraska, which, you know, for those of us who are historically minded, was the birthplace of American populism? So, you know, Nebraska, although we think of it now as a deep red, mostly Republican, reliably Republican state, it wasn't that long ago that you sent Democrats to the Senate. And, you know, there's some thought that at least one of your congressional districts might be in play. But tell me, you know, we allow ourselves to do the horse race here. So I do want to hear how you think things are going electorally. But I also want to know what you think hasn't been said yet, needs to be said yet, could move the needle in your state.
You know, I think a lot of us often refer to our red states as under-resourced states rather than red states. We know, for example, that we win on issues when it comes to ballot campaigns, and we have four this year on the ballot: abortion, medical marijuana, protecting public school funding from vouchers, and paid sick leave. These are all very popular in our rural communities that the Harris and Walz campaign obviously are going to be making sure are included on the voter guides that we're sending out. So I think connecting issues that rural people first identify with and definitely support necessarily versus sometimes the partisan lean. I mean, Anthony's 100% right. Most people say you lose about 30 points if there's a D behind your name in rural communities right out of the gate. And we have so much to work up. The good thing is that Harris and Walz know all these things, and they have hired really good rural people. So Matt Hildreth is their lead rural organizer. He comes from the grassroots. He knows all the issues. They've already put out a 2-page policy paper that a lot of us on the front lines are getting out to our networks. And they're talking specific things. So they're definitely making the point that in Project 2025, Trump would remove crop insurance, which really is bank insurance because it's how farmers are able to lend every year despite the high risk of growing food to feed America and the world. And Trump would do away with that safety net. And so Harris and Walz are talking about how they would not only support that, but make sure that there's other kind of safeguards in place for our family farmers and ranchers so you don't have to go corporate. You can still stay small. So that's the type of thing that definitely is working in Nebraska. That's why I think you're seeing things like in Iowa coming closer. I never give up on our allies in like South Dakota, North Dakota, and some of the red states because there's winnable races in all of these states.
Well, it's interesting that you said you don't have to go corporate because one of the things that I confess I haven't paid as much attention to, like most big city journalists, so maybe I'm not alone in this. Maybe I shouldn't feel particularly personally at fault. But, you know, my friend and Nation editorial board member, Zephyr Teachout, gave a much-viewed TED Talk on chickenization and big ag. And that was before Biden became president. So they've had 4 years. Have they done anything about big ag?
Well, a couple of things. So I think they've done more than any presidency in my lifetime on big everything. Big pharma, big tech, publishing, airlines, and ag. So it's not just big ag that's negatively impacted and stripped rural communities of their economy. There's a lot of other corporate consolidation that has really hurt other bread and butter rural industry. So that's one thing to note. And their record in 3.5 years is so far beyond the last 40 years of Democrats and Republicans. It's amazing. On big ag, I think the most encouraging thing is right now you have Lena Khan, the warrior, for antitrust, kind of in a sense playing backup and reinforcing the efforts of Vilsack and USDA to really seriously reform the Packers and Stockyards Act. They've taken a couple of steps. They've implemented some new rules that the big chicken and big hog and big beef people did not want. But now they're talking about some much more serious changes to those rules that would finally make it possible, at least possible, for all of these contract producers to actually make a decent living without so much risk, right? Up to this point, essentially the laws have changed such that all the risk is on the producer, and they're at mercy of the big ag. So I think they're taking the right steps. I sure hope that with Walls on the ticket, VP Harris doesn't get cold feet and succumb to some of the pressures that are coming from rich Dem donors. That's my worry.
Well, we're all looking at Silicon Valley, and we're looking at, you know, the dumplina con moves by people who, you know, are writing 7- and 8-figure checks to the campaign. So that's definitely still up in the air. It's interesting though, because you mentioned Tom Vilsack, and I remember when he was picked, he was a controversial pick among rural Dems. You know, he was not seen as somebody who was necessarily going to take on corporate ag. What's your view, Jane, of how, whether that perception remains or whether it's changed?
What's interesting is I think Vilsack really took that criticism to heart, and you saw it reflected in changes of policy. So, for example, you know, obviously corporate meatpacking is a big deal for us in rural places. It's difficult sometimes to get product to the big cities, where a lot of times the meatpacking are, or if the meatpackers are in rural areas, it's usually, you know, one of the three big. So what he's done is he's given real money to organizations, private organizations, who are now starting their own meatpacking in small towns that are smaller, that are definitely catering towards the smaller producers. One is being built in Nebraska, in outside of North Platte. So he definitely heard that loud and clear. He also heard loud and clear, one of the challenges that we have is that, you know, a good 15% of our farmers used to be African-American farmers, you know, raising not only meat and vegetables, but lots of other products like cotton and linen, et cetera. And now that's about 1% because of all the corporate consolidation, especially in the 80s, that happened when farmers, you know, were getting hit really hard and banks were coming after them and taking up their land, and it went to big corporations. He has a lot of land back programs for not only Native Americans, but Black and Latino farmers, first time farmers. That's been a big shift. And he's also, you know, invested in programs that we've always supported, veterans. You know, rural communities and communities of color send the most people into the military, right? There's lots of actually things that communities color and rural people share. It's just the media likes to divide us. And that's one of them. And so there's a lot of veterans in our rural communities, and they are ideal for starting farms and ranches, or taking over their family farm and ranch. And so he's put a lot of money into those programs too. So from our perspective, he's definitely done a million times better. I didn't even touch on, which I could, all the clean energy investments that Department of Ag is also doing, which is helping folks and cover crops and other kind of climate resiliency that he's really leaned in.
Well, just to add to that, I mean, it's so true. I was at a gathering in May at the White House. It was Rural Communities in Action, and a lot of great stuff came up there. But when Tom Vilsack spoke and he said, for too long, we've driven agriculture with the idea of get big or get out. He said that was a huge mistake, right? We're changing that here and now. We're investing in family farmers, mid-size agriculture processing. And it was incredible. And I knew it was real because at that point, they had already, as Jane said, started to put real money into regional food processing, into the infrastructure that's needed. But it was, I thought that he had died and come back as Jim Hightower. I mean, it was amazing. I thought, this is Tom Vilsack. He's just had a come to Jesus moment. So it's a new Vilsack and a new approach to ag.
And do you think that has been recognized in, you know, in your states?
it's been recognized some, but I will say this is where the campaign could be making leaps and bounds in getting rural voters back into our party and voting for them, simply campaigning on rural radio and some of the rural publications and really bragging about not only what Biden and Harris did and what Harris and Walz's plan is for the next 4 years. And, you know, that's not happening enough. There's just no question about it. I mean, I love everything that the Harris and Walz team is doing, but it's like there's not enough rural people inside that campaign that is delivering these messages. And so it's almost like this is the only parallel I have is sometimes you don't hear Democrats talking about the ins and outs of climate change enough because they're worried that they're not saying the science right. And so I sometimes worry that Democrats aren't saying rural enough because they're worried about getting it wrong. And there's so much that our party has done to lift up rural communities, not just obviously on ag, but on hospitals and on clean energy and so many things that are helping develop the economies of our rural towns and immigration. You know, so many of our rural communities are alive today because immigrants are choosing to move to our rural towns because of safe communities, education, and job availability. So we could be winning more if we talked about the things we are doing to deliver for rural America.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you talk about the way in which immigration is saving rural communities. It's a thing I saw even 2 weeks ago in Pennsylvania. You know, I was traveling in central Pennsylvania, and you're in towns that have been dying for 30 years. The biggest, you know, their populations peaked in 1930. And, you know, now they're heading up, and they're heading up, and the sort of, you hear Spanish on the streets because you get people who are priced out of the Bronx, people who are priced out of, you know, parts of Brooklyn. And there's cheap housing and there's not high paying jobs, but there are jobs in these places and people are moving there. But then you see what's happening in Columbus, you know, in Ohio, and you see, you don't see the Democratic campaign rushing in to defend these people. So I'm wondering, you know, why you think that is.
It's interesting because the Springfield, you know, issue where Vance was making up all these stories about Haitian brothers and sisters, and you really did see kind of cross-partisan folks on the ground in Springfield and then clearly nationally Democrats defending folks. I just think as Democrats, it is not our immediately go-to position to lift up rural communities and lift up immigrants in our rural communities because they don't know enough of us, right? The majority of leaders in our party, both at the DNC, the DTRIP, you know, all the alphabet soup of our Democratic committees are mostly from the coasts or blue states. And so when we're in these rooms talking about messaging or investments, it's usually people bringing their own experiences to the table, and that's where those investments go. Sounds simplistic, but I've been in the room. So if you don't have a me, an Anthony, a Matt Hildreth, a Jim Hightower in the room saying, wait a second, you know, we raised $49 million in one day off of the debate. Maybe we should put $5 million into rural radio and deliver some clear messages about how we have helped small family farmers and all the things that we've done and lift up immigration as an issue. That's what we need. It sounds simplistic, but that's really what we need.
And the other thing that relates to that, I think the opportunity, I mean, radio is so untapped. It's been dominated by the right for so many decades now. And we've been saying in every chance we can that congressional candidates, state candidates, and certainly the federal, it is such a bargain. Rural radio is such a daggone bargain. But even beyond that, I would love to see more of what they have started doing, which is showing up, not just in rural, but showing up where the success stories are happening. On, I think it's September 25th, somewhere around there, I know there's going to be an event in Wisconsin that's co-hosted by the Wisconsin Farmers Union. And it's going to take place, part of the event's going to be a tour of one of their new facilities, one of these integrated facilities that's aggregation, food processing, meeting space, the whole bit. Well, those things are dotting the landscape all over the country. Democrats, one of our problems is that country people think we're all talk. We just talk so damn much, but we don't actually do anything. Well, that's not true. But we do talk so damn much, so it's pretty easy. It's pretty easy to forget that actually we do stuff. So I love it when the campaign shows up, whether it's the top of the ticket or their you know, other folks from the cabinet at places where local people have changed the game, where local people, whether it's in ag or healthcare or downtown revitalization, they have thousands of places they can go in rural areas to say, hey, when we work together and the federal government's a partner, things change for the better. That's where I think the campaign should be spending a lot of time, on the ground at places where things have already begun to happen.
Well, let's step back a little bit, because there's something you said when we began, Anthony, which is that in rural communities, because here on the coasts, we have come to think of and dismiss J.D. Vance as a laughingstock, a joke. And, you know, you wrote a piece for The Nation cautioning against doing that. But of course, that was written before he did some of the more risible and even contemptible things he's been doing. But yet the fact that he still polls better than Tim Walz makes me wonder, you know, have the Democrats just lost? Should we be right? You know, I guess I'm kind of being the devil's advocate here and going against what you guys have been saying. You know, maybe if you have limited resources, you just shouldn't waste time pouring them down the rat hole of communities that, no matter what you say, are still going to prefer J.D. Vance to Tim Walz. How do you answer that?
Right. I feel like I've spent 3/4 of my life the last 20 years trying to answer that. So a couple of quick thoughts. I'll see if I can be organized about this. Number one, that notion, that sort of triage notion, that we could never win over those people, so let's put our resources closer to the cities. Dems have been doing that for 20 to 30 years, and it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy. Places like the 9th District of Virginia were competitive for Dems. We had a Dem congressman for 28 years. We had Dem representatives to the State House and Senate until about 17, 18 years ago. We've gone from being close to 50-50 to being 80-20. And that's because Dems pulled out. They ceded the ground in every way, from talk radio to political presence to policy. So that's one quick thing. If we keep doing that, it only gets worse and worse. Second thing is, I think the difference between Vance and Walz, which is right now on a favorability scale, about 20 points. It's not as big as one would think, actually, because of Vance's relative unpopularity and Walz getting some begrudging support from rural people who never want to support a Democrat. So I think we've got a place to start to narrow that gap. And I think some focus on the two vice presidential candidates could really make a difference, especially when you look at Walz's record. Walz's record going after big corporations. He's got the best record of anybody on either ticket on that. And Walz's rural record is the best one. So I think they really have a place to start there. Pulling out would be a disaster.
Yeah, rural folks definitely know Vance more than they do Walz, because Vance is on their media stream. So whether it's Fox or some of the other more right-leaning media, Vance has been a darling of those outlets for years. And so, you know, I think that's, you know, one starting point is Walz has some plenty of room to grow. The vice presidential debate is going to be critical for Walz and our rural outreach. You know, Rural for Harris is a group of volunteers. Anthony's part of it. I am too. And we're going to be holding, you know, pep rally potlucks all across the country, encouraging our rural folks to, you know, make a hot dish, make a casserole, do whatever is, you know, popular in your neck of the woods, and encouraging, you know, small groups to get together to watch Walz, cheer him on, put up yard signs so we can have more conversations. It's just like, you know, I always say, look, if Nike was going to put out a shoe and then got upset when they did no advertising that nobody bought the shoe, you know, they wouldn't blame the customer. They would blame their PR and advertising department. And so as Democrats, we have to start realizing that we have stopped investing, talking to, doing much in our rural communities, and a little money goes a long way in our rural towns.
And one more thing, Don, don't forget that the studies show that over the last roughly four federal election cycles, rural voters have been the swingiest. Rural voters, more than any other subset, have moved between blue and red more than any other group. So I think, again, the left and Democrats in the coast tend to think of all rural voters, there's a small group of liberals, and then everybody else is immovable. That's not true. They're actually the most movable.
Well, I have to say, that is news to me and extremely interesting.
Yeah.
The new book, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, gives readers a rare opportunity to engage with the Congresswoman's powerful ideas in her own voice. Many Americans are familiar with Chisholm's importance as the first Black woman in Congress and the first woman and African American to run for president with either major party. This collection of her work establishes Chisholm as an unparalleled public intellectual and Black feminist both in her time and now. Learn more about Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, at ucpress.edu.
Let's talk about Democratic Party organization and sort of the corporate wing of the Democratic Party and what one needs to do to keep it from drowning out this possible good news. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of the fact that when the vice president decided to distinguish herself from Joe Biden and his record, which, however good it might have been in rural America, was leading the party to a terrible defeat in the poll. You know, the polls seem pretty clear. I mean, so clear that the party actually acted, that whatever Biden's actual policies had done, they were not landing in all sorts of American communities, including rural America. So, you know, the change at the top of the ticket clearly released a lot of energy. But in terms of differentiating herself, she differentiated herself by saying, I'm not going to tax capital gains quite as much as Biden was going to do. And I thought, really? That's where you're drawing the line? So, you know, what does she need to do to distinguish herself from the Biden record, aside from picking Tim Walz? Or what does Walz need to say and Harris need to say to make it clear that this is really going to be different?
There is something about the politics of joy that Walz and Harris have tapped into that is definitely appealing to rural voters. And I think you're going to see a lot of that on stage at the vice presidential debate with Walz. And you saw that as a clear indication of difference between Harris and Trump when they debated. You know, Trump came off as very angry and divisive, which he is. And Americans really don't like that and are tired of it. And even though we've had Harris and Walz for 4 years, we still had looming Trump negativity and divisiveness over our country's politics, really for the past 8 or 10 years, starting with the Tea Party. So, you know, I think that will be a key indicator. You know, joy and hope and optimism are something that we lean into in our rural communities. And so that's going to be, I think, one of the biggest things that Walz needs to accomplish. And he needs to say specifics. I think Harris talking about the $25,000, for example, for first-time home buyers was really appealing, something different than, you know, you heard Biden talking more about student loans, which was also very important and critical, and they got done a ton. So I think you'll hear some specifics from Walz. Obviously, as rural people, we want to hear him talk about right to repair, ending eminent domain, you know, some of the key things that us rural folks have been wanting for years, but haven't really got the Democratic Party or our leaders talking about. Might be asking too much for the debate, but we'll take happiness and joy.
Well, wait, no, let's not take happiness and joy, because I'm going to be rude and point out that that's kind of a vibe answer to a policy question. So why don't you use the little bit of time we have left with you, Jane, to talk about why right to repair is important and why eminent domain is important? Because I bet a lot of our listeners won't know what the heck we're talking about.
Yeah. And these are two issues, you know, that Anthony and I talk about often and a lot of rural leaders that actually bridge rural and urban, because both of these impact rural and urban voters. So right to repair for farmers and ranchers basically means they can fix their tractors without having the warranty voided out. You know, you're now having to bring your John Deere tractor to a John Deere dealer and, you know, somebody who's certified as a maintenance person on John Deere's. And sometimes that means your then tractor is out of the field for a week or more, depending on if there's a lot of people ahead of you, which often happens in our rural towns. So if you can fix it, which a lot of our folks in rural communities can, or take it to your local, you know, mechanic, then that's easier and better for you. that is for urban people who don't have tractors, but they have iPhones. And so oftentimes our screens get broken or something's glitching. We want to just take it to the mall, iPhone, you know, repair shop in the mall that's not a certified Apple dealer, you know, and then that means our warranty is also voided on our phones. And so right to repair basically means we can fix stuff on ourselves or take it to our local mechanics and shops and get things fixed without having warranties voided. Really important, anti-monopoly type, very populist policy. Rural people want it. They talk about it all the time. Eminent domain, you know, land use and land are critical issues in our rural communities. Whether you own a farm or a ranch or you don't, it is absolutely critical that a private corporation, especially a foreign owned one, can't come into our country and take your land for a private gain project. We get when roads or bridges are needed, sometimes land, railroads, et cetera. We understand that. And this happens in urban communities too. When big football stadiums are going to be built, guess whose homes are being taken by eminent domain? Black and brown folks. And so this is an issue that really is popular in rural. It's popular in urban. Every time Bold does a poll across the state, it's 81% people, yes, agree, eminent domain should not be used for private gain. We can fix that at the federal level if we put some muscle into it.
So building on that, I mean, I think right to repair, which seems like an esoteric issue, would be an incredibly important thing for Waltz to bring up in the debate. I don't know if J.D. Vance knows about it. He might, but Waltz could bring that up. The right to repair and the eminent domain, they have in common tapping into such a critical rural value, which is the desire for self-reliance. People want to be able to take care of their own needs. Every bit of research we've done and all of my experience in rural Appalachia says that people don't want to hear a message that says the government's going to take care of this for you. The Democrats talk from that government will solve the problem, social safety net perspective a lot. Rarely do we talk, sometimes, but rarely do we talk about enabling people to fix their own problems, solve their own problems. That's what controlling your land and stopping eminent domain for commercial gain is. That's what right to repair is. It's just a minor shift in language, but a huge difference in emphasis. And rural people, again, they don't want big government solutions. They want the government to invest in local people's solutions. We know that. That's critical. The other thing, if I can, that relate to that. So I think one change in language and policy, because policy would follow, like focusing on right to repair and eminent domain, is around the self-reliance. What can we do to enable rural people and communities to solve their own problems? The second language thing that the campaign, the Harris-Walz campaign, uses all the time, Dems use all the time, is this going forward versus going backward. Dems say it so much they never even think that anybody could possibly see that as a negative. Harris says, Trump wants to take us backwards. We're going forward. We're about the future. They're about the past. It's like liberals think, who could argue with that? Well, I'll tell you who could argue with that. People whose future has been getting steadily worse for the last 30 years, which is a whole lot of working class rural people. Each generation over the last couple of decades, three decades, has had poorer economic outcomes, more economic security, insecurity, lower wages, lower real wages. So if you're always talking about the future, and yet the future in your experience just keeps getting worse and worse, why wouldn't you connect with somebody who says we're going to make America great again? Because the past probably was better for you. So I think these are really small but critical changes the campaign could make and recognize that by focusing on people's ability to help themselves, the self-reliance, they could win over a lot of rural voters.
Okay. You've been fantastic, as always. Great to see you. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for this. This has been great.
Yeah, thank you.
And I'm joined now by Sarah Tabor, a sometime Nation contributor and currently candidate for Agriculture Commissioner of the state of North Carolina. So, Sarah, welcome. And I guess my first question, since we're speaking after Hurricane Helene battered your state, is where are you and how are you?
Sure. I'm staying with a friend in Charlotte. It's Kate Compton Barr, actually, who's making quite a splash running in a gerrymandered to heck district and doing a great job of it. She very kindly is offering her home to a lot of folks who are, you know, running for office and also now with the storm effort. So Charlotte is outside the blast zone, so there's not a whole lot of effect here. But as you go west pretty quickly, you start, honestly, it's hard to get any information out of it, right? There's a lot of conflicting reports. There's not a lot of information. A lot of towns just lost cell coverage. Cell towers and radio towers either lost power or just have come off the mountain. So we're, I think, really still figuring out what's going on out here. You want to be cautious about rushing in. You know, if the roads are very difficult, you want to make sure that emergency crews have the clearance to use them. So we're doing the best we can to figure out exactly what's going on and how to get supplies where they need to go. Like, that's where it's at right now.
We're here to talk about the rural vote and rural voters, but let's start a little bit with your story and how you came to run for office, and specifically agriculture commissioner. So what does the agricultural commissioner do in North Carolina?
So in most states, agriculture commissioner is not elected. It's an appointed position by the governor. But there's about 12 states where this person's elected, mostly in the South and in the Great Plains and Midwest. The responsibilities vary by state. Here in North Carolina, commissioner of agriculture obviously has a lot of responsibility for agriculture, but also handling livestock diseases. If there's a bird flu outbreak, this is the person who makes sure they don't spread to other farms. You know, we don't start getting crossovers into people. It's in charge of wildfire control. So forest fires, we typically think of that as a Western issue, but there's surprisingly a lot of it in the South. Our forests do need fire to stay healthy, and we want to make sure that it's controlled chill fire. It's not out of control wildfire. And we've been having a harder and harder time, you know, keeping that where it needs to be because we're getting longer, hotter, dry spells and more people building developments into forested areas. And close to half our state is forest. So that's a big responsibility. Pet shelters also are under Commissioner of Agriculture here. We have one of the highest kill rates in the country. So there's definitely some room for improvement there. And consumer protection also. It is possible for grocery stores to overcharge you for things by weight or the price on the register and the shelf just don't match. That's been becoming more frequent as food prices have gone up. And so it's a basic consumer protection job here in North Carolina. The Commissioner of Agriculture inspects businesses' scales to make sure they're charging people appropriately because they're over weights and measures. So there's a lot of big responsibilities here. And there's a perception that the Commissioner of Agriculture is there for farmers. And I tell them that's about as true as the Attorney General is there for lawyers, right? It's a job to make sure that a system in a state is working properly. It's not just for one profession.
Right. And what's your background that led you to think something needed to be changed in North Carolina?
Sure. So I've worked in agriculture 27 years, and that has taken me all over the country, you know, including a lot of time in the Southeast, including North Carolina. And I saw that the economic situation in North Carolina agriculture is not good. The farmers here can make as little as half as much per acre as their peers in Georgia and Virginia. So that's not soil. That's not weather. What is it? It's a people thing, right? So we're really just focusing on growing things that don't make a lot of money here. And it sounds goofy, but it is honestly in many ways that simple. There's a big focus on corn, soy, and tobacco. And tobacco, like traditionally, was North Carolina's big cash crop, but it doesn't make that much money anymore. And I think compared to a lot of other cash crops like fruits and vegetables, it's actually never made that much money, but it made enough that you could base a whole state's agriculture on it. So there was a price support program for tobacco from the Great Depression through 2004. And that got a lot of people used to trading tobacco as the cash crop. If you had a ticket to grow tobacco under that artificial price support program, I'm not going to say it was printing money. You still had to work for it, but it was a guaranteed market and guaranteed good money.
Right. But that ended in 2004.
It ended in 2004. Yeah. So now we're experiencing a free market, honestly, for what you might call the first time here in North Carolina, the closest thing to a free market for crops. And that's been really challenging if you've got three generations of folks and then also a history of labor where you also did not have to be competitive on the labor market, right, as a farm. So that's hitting farmers pretty hard. There are ways to navigate that. That's what I've been helping farmers do for, you know, over a decade of my farm career, is helping figure out what's going on in the market. What are the opportunities for me? Don't just copy what my neighbors do, but let's do something that's going to make money for me personally today here, you know, in our current market conditions. And I see a huge need for that here in North Carolina. There's so much treating agriculture as a thing from the past that we need to preserve. And I'm like, no, agriculture is about, we have a future we got to think about. We know the markets are changing, you know, economic conditions change, the climate is changing. You know, the opportunities, you know, there are things that used to make money that don't anymore, but there are also things that make good money now that were not an opportunity 20 years ago. So let's keep walking forward and keep making decisions for ourselves and making good decisions for ourselves.
And how does that lack of leadership play into the long time political party history of North Carolina?
So the Commissioner of Agriculture became a Republican held office about 20 years ago, and there's been one guy holding it since then. It's hard to say even it's a party thing. It's just that one particular guy in many cases. North Carolina is one of the few places where, you know, Southern Democrats really hung on for a long time post-civil rights. You know, like, that's not the reason a lot of people left the Democratic Party here. You know, NAFTA and just economic changes in the 90s had a lot more to do with it. And because of that, a lot of folks got really disaffected. And like, it was really the Tea Party surge, you know, like in the 2010s that flipped North Carolina over. So it wasn't even a rural movement really that caused the flip of North Carolina to Republican. It was urban Republicans really asserting their power. And I think you can see that in what's happened to rural North Carolina. They talk a good game about respecting the rural economy, but when it comes to what they're actually doing, our rural economy shrunk in real terms, like over a fifth since this guy took power 20 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. What you need to do to keep your rural economy fresh is you can't just pick, we're going to grow these three things and ride that for 400 years. You know, you have to pay attention to changing markets. So fruits and vegetables are a really good opportunity for us now. Changing market conditions, there's more people here than there were, you know, 20 years ago. That means there's more people who can buy highly perishable things. We didn't have that a few decades ago, right? Our weather is, we're getting a longer, hotter dry spell in spring, which actually like killed a lot of our corn crop this year. It's bad for grain, but it can be really, really good for fruits and vegetables. They actually like warm, dry weather. That's why California has been so dominant for so long. And at the same time, California is running out of land and water. So we have new opportunities that are coming our way. It's not just challenges. We have new opportunities. And so you need leadership that knows what that is. So something that's exciting here, two things. My opponent is the most popular politician in North Carolina. He got more votes than Trump. He got more votes than Governor Cooper. He is the most popular guy in North Carolina politics.
So you have, as they say, a hill to climb, Sarah.
A bit, you know, but that's what we do here. And normally he wins his elections by 9 or 10 points. We already have him down to the margin of error with a fifth of voters still left undecided. So
you've got
very pleased about that.
A little over a month to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're not, we're not, you know, like working hard or anything. No, we're working very hard. It's exciting to be here, and it's historical just to have made it this far. So we're excited about that. Second, folks would assume that if you have a politician who's in agriculture, right, and he wins that hard every time, he must have a ton of rural support. No, there are not enough rural North Carolinians to make someone win that hard, right? We're one of the most rural states in the country, and that's still not enough people to get it done like that. He also lost 11 rural counties last election.
So there's an opening.
Yeah. So what's really going on is there are about 200,000 people in North Carolina who vote for a Democrat for almost every position, except this one, you know, Democrat for governor, Democrat for president, attorney general, all the way on down, except ag commissioner. Because Republicans have this brand, right, of we're good at agriculture. And almost the vast majority of the folks who do this crossover vote are not in rural areas. Rural Democrats don't do that. They know what's going on. That's why he lost 11 rural counties. It's almost entirely folks in the research triangle. So this is urban folks who are not connected to agriculture in any meaningful way. They just know that Republicans have a brand. And I think a lot of folks think of themselves as like, I'm bipartisan and fair. This is my chance to prove it. I heard farmers like Republicans. Well, a lot of them don't. That's why he lost 11 rural counties. So we're just getting that word out.
So how do you rate your chances and how do you rate Harris Walz's chances?
I think Harris Walz's chances are great. There's a ton of excitement for her and for him here in the state. And for me, that's up to the people of North Carolina. We came into this knowing we've got a tough hill to climb. It's just going to be neck and neck until this thing is done.
So how does this translate in terms of what the voters you talk to every day? Because I assume that's been your job for the last few months, is talking to voters every day. What issues are particularly salient for them, and how does that interact with the top of the ticket campaign?
So Commissioner of Agriculture, obviously, it's a different group of responsibilities than a lot of the things that Democrats typically run on. You know, social issues, you know, there's some that comes across here. Like, obviously, equitable access to capital is huge. That's long been a big problem in North Carolina. But things like, you know, abortion and Social Security doesn't really have much to do with the Commissioner of Agriculture. This is a job that is about finance and economic development. So again, my job for a decade has been working with farmers on how we're going to make more money. And I like to tell Democrats, a lot of these rural issues that we're concerned about, right? Pollution, you know, worker well-being, pay. How do we make all those things happen? Farms got to make more money. They got to make the money to pay people, right? They got to make the money to do environmental, you know, like all those environmental protections. So at the end of the day, this financial position has a lot of power over those things that, you know, you want to see from the left that you might not necessarily think of as an economic responsibility, but they are.
And when you go out on the doorstep I understand that your focus is on agriculture and the agricultural economy, but do people talk about national issues? And if so, what do they say to you?
Honestly, no. You know, like we talk about food, we talk about cost of living, you know, and those are national issues, but they're also like very hyper-local issues, right?
Does the national ticket not come up because you are making an effort not to bring it up or because people don't bring it up?
Oh, no. Like people are really excited about the national ticket. It obviously depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking with a farmer, you're not like, and that Harris, they're probably not going to be into that, right? When you're talking to voters, you've got to be latched into what they're interested in, right? How is this going to impact them? How's it going to affect them? So if I'm talking with someone who's farming, you know, 9,000 acres of grain, we're going to have a very different conversation than, you know, your average in an apartment building voter. It's about knowing like what impacts and what connects for people. So obviously, once you get in office, you can't pursue two different kinds of policies. But when you're talking to two different kinds of voters, their policies are going to help both of them, and you talk about them in different ways, right? So for example, if you're talking to someone who's living in an apartment building, like farmers not making money doesn't really affect them, right? But grocery prices affect them. If you're talking to farmers, the grocery prices can't affect them because they, you know, they shop for food. They buy most of their food as well. And also the fact that, you know, the grocery stores are raising their prices, they're overcharging people. How much of that actually makes it back to the farmer?
Well, not much, apparently.
Yeah, there's a whole food system between them. So the same issues can play out very differently for different kinds of people. You know, so there's some things you would do to handle both those issues. We're going to build more local food systems, right? So that there's more competition, more food being grown here locally, so that, you know, farmers have more markets here, but also there's competition, right, in our grocery stores for different kinds of food. That's going to help prices be mitigated. Antitrust work. There are parts of antitrust that matter a lot for consumers, right? Again, grocery prices. There's parts of antitrust that matter for farmers. More market opportunities because there's not just one or two companies they can deal with.
And do you feel that there is significant, some, no resistance to your message because there's a D after your name?
Again, it depends on who you're talking to. There are a lot of farmers out there who are never going to be excited about a Democrat, even if we can make them more money. To that end, like, well, that's a personal problem, you know. I would also point out that there are 40,000 farmers in the state of North Carolina and close to 10 million people. So you can win every single farmer over, and that's not going to make a decisive change in your electoral outcomes. What you need to do is make a clear case to people who are not farmers but care about farming about why we're going to do some things better. We're going to have more opportunities. And just because an individual farmer personally feels Republican for their own personal reasons that are not just economic, you know, you as a consumer, you can still make decisions for yourself based on economic issues and understand that that's also going to be good for rural areas.
Do you have a sense of what it would take for Democrats to be more generally competitive in rural areas?
I mean, I haven't been all Democrats before. I've only been myself, you know. But I find that, you know, just being able to talk shop with people is really helpful. That's a new experience. You know, it doesn't always mean like, oh, well, I'm thinking about Democrats differently now. That certainly is the case for a lot of people. Some folks just look at you like you're a dog that's walking on their hind legs. They're like, huh, interesting.
You care about farmers and you're a Democrat? How is that possible?
Yeah, I haven't ever had anybody like say that to my face in quite that way before. But, you know, they're like, well, I still hate Democrats because of X, Y, and Z. I'm like, cool. We're still going to make you more money. That's your business. You know, sorry. And then just making it clear to consumers like how badly the Republican leadership in agriculture has screwed up the state. I think making that clear to people has been surprising because our current commissioner of agriculture's economic track record is terrible. And nobody's ever really pointed that out before. We've had a lot of folks run against him, you know, on social issues, on just, hey, I'm a rural guy too, but I'm a Democrat. We've had people do those approaches and, you know, no shakes on them. They did the best they could. But I saw, because I work on the economics and the business side of agriculture so much, I saw how much of a black hole North Carolina agriculture is in. And I said, what if we talked to voters about that? And we're trying it, and it's working.
Now, I recall that the last piece you wrote for us was about a particular Republican who had some economic experience in your state. And I wondered if you'd care to say more about J.D. Vance and his career in agriculture.
Well, J.D. Vance has been involved in a lot of things. He was involved in App Harvest, short for Appalachian Harvest, I guess, which was a greenhouse company based in Kentucky. My family, my mom's side of the family is from Harlan County, Kentucky, by the way. So Southern by birth, North Carolina by choice, you know. So that's the area in agriculture I was working in quite a bit was greenhouses, indoor farms, like the tech startups that are doing like the fancy indoor with lighting. Also, my first client was Amish. So we've worked at all ends of the technology scale here.
indoor farms with lighting, but not necessarily growing marijuana.
Yeah, they're all lettuce because I also, the main, one of the things they would call me for is food safety, and no one's making the marijuana guys do food safety. So I would happily work with one of them, just they haven't called me. So it was mostly, you know, veggies, leafy greens, you know, vegetables, that kind of thing. So we're working in markets where there's not a lot of margin for profit, right? We're working in a very competitive area. There's huge premiums in weed. You can be really bad at growing marijuana and still make lots of money. Probably less so now than it was earlier. Nobody take this as investment advice, but I'm just saying, you know, the profit margin situation is very different. So I'd work with folks who are in vegetable markets that are very, very competitive. There's not a lot of margin. You're having lots of competition with marijuana. You just kind of have the state to yourself. You're not competing with folks in other states. In produce, it can be coming from other countries, right? So you have to be on top of your game. So I would help folks with all kinds of things. They would often bring me on for regulatory stuff because that's when they realized they needed help, but they needed help in a lot of things. So we wound up working with hiring. How many people do you need? What kind of qualifications and background? How do we train them for these tasks?
And Vance's company, what were they supposed to do?
They were supposed to be growing tomatoes. My understanding from talking with folks who were involved in it, because at least one of their people called me for help because they needed some. But yeah, App Harvest wasn't totally clear from my understanding of whether it wanted to be we're a company that grows tomatoes or a company that makes robots to grow tomatoes. That was part of their issue, I think. They weren't totally clear on that. They also didn't really do the work to sell the tomatoes they were growing themselves. This is something I haven't seen come up in any of the reporting. My understanding is they were selling it through a different company. So they basically had a middleman who was taking a big cut. How do you get $800 million to run your business and then you sell through a fence? You know, who's taking a big cut? What are you doing? So just like the basic business model that they had going was not good. And to have $800 million go into a company just like that incompetent from the outset was wild to me to watch.
And this is a company where Vance was one of the main front men investors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so something I've heard was, well, you know, the bad stuff happened after he left. Well, you don't get bad stuff like that happening without really bad leadership right at the start, right? You don't get a company just, I don't really have words, just that badly run. Like you can't get that without the top brass really, really not knowing what they're doing with direct involvement. Like there's just, and I feel like he was kind of brought on to bring rural legitimacy. And that's not a thing. You either have experience growing food or you don't. It's not, you don't pick that up by osmosis, you know, just because you live somewhere rural.
But isn't that this whole USP is that he's the voice of rural America?
Sure. Yeah. And if you don't know any better, you'd believe it. Sure. Yeah. So like, yeah.
What is it that strikes you most about that claim that he's the voice of rural America?
I mean, grew up in the suburbs in Cincinnati, first off. If you're going to go on that, you can pick up rural authenticity by osmosis. It doesn't happen there.
Well, thanks again, Sarah. It's a pleasure to finally meet you.
Yeah, likewise.